Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Christina Greer, sitting in for Brian. Good morning, everyone. With the recent events in Charlottesville, racism is again in America, is on the forefront of many conversations we're having. And our next guest, Glenn Martin, looks specifically at the issue of mass incarceration and race. His firsthand experience with this issue from when he spent 1 year incarcerated in the notoriously violent Rikers Island jail and four more at New York State Prison two decades ago. He has since used his experience to inform his career and drive his mission to cut the United States prison population by half in 2030. He's the founder of Just Leaders USA and the hashtag Close Rikers campaign, and joins us today to talk about his efforts and whether the momentum to end mass incarceration continues under the Trump administration. Glenn, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back. Good to be with you.
So I want to get right into it. The campaign to close Rikers Island has been incredibly successful in that Mayor de Blasio announced earlier this year that he does endorse a plan to close it, although it will take 10 years. So where are we in that process?
You know, I'm glad we're segueing into this conversation after talking about Charlottesville because, you know, if you care about social justice, jails and prisons really are the belly of the beast. And while I'm really pleased that the mayor is undergoing this 3-month effort to identify symbols of white supremacy in New York City, I would argue that he can start with Rikers Island, a piece of land that was purchased from a man who was a judge in New York who would capture free black men and return them into slavery in the South. And so, in my opinion, Rikers Island stands as a monument to white supremacy right here in the middle of one of the most progressive, resource-rich cities in the country. So I'm pleased that we got the mayor to the point where he's willing to say we should close down Rikers. But a decade for people who've been harmed by Rikers translates into 470,000 people put into those cages over the next 10 years, 418,000 of them people of color. $13 billion spent to continue to run Rikers Island, and on average, about 50,000 uses of force based on where we are today.
Well, I always made the argument that if the mayor actually waited 10 years, then those students that he was able to help get into universal pre-K would actually be in high school by the time Rikers closed. So that's quite a long time. So I think it's a really important point, though, that you make. As we talked about yesterday, really linking all of these symbols and monuments that we walk past on a daily basis to the white supremacy that we've seen in this nation from its inception. And so there's more to reforming New York's criminal justice system than just closing one big jail, essentially, that may represent itself as a monument to a legacy of white supremacy and slavery. And so instead of just closing one big jail complex in favor of just establishing smaller jails in each of the boroughs, so I want you to talk to us, walk us through that,
sure.
And the strategy behind that. And also, there was a recent example that was example of action that was taken by four of the five city district attorneys to dismiss some of the 600,000 old warrants and summonses. And so I want you to sort of explain how that would even get disseminated in this new idea of these kind of new jails on the five boroughs and how we'd even figure out these dismissals.
Sure. Let me focus on the Rikers piece first. The reason my organization, Just Leadership USA, undertook a campaign to shutter Rikers Island is because we care about what we call decarceration, shrinking the footprint of the correctional system in the lives of all New Yorkers. And so that means parole, probation, correction, you name it. And Rikers Island, for people who've been harmed by our criminal justice system, really is something that gets them fired up. And at the same time, to close Rikers, you actually have to cut the population in half. When I was at Rikers serving time, there were 22,000 people there. Now, citywide, because we do have other jails in New York City, we're down to about 9,200 people. So we've already been able to cut the population in half and increase public safety in New York to levels of 1961.
While we're experiencing record lows in crime.
Absolutely. And so the policy reforms that need to happen are speedy trial reform, discovery reform, bail reform, and probably most importantly, policing. And this segues into the question you just asked me about the leadership of four of the five DAs in New York City. The Staten Island DA has yet to get on board. Staten Island, the deep south of New York. and so the dismissal of those warrants, let me say what it means. So first of all, these warrants come out of overzealous broken windows policing in New York City. And so the majority of these warrants date back to a time when we had a mayor who was comfortable with allowing NYPD to stop and frisk over 800,000 people each year in New York.
The and majority that mayor
of
would
them
be?
Mayor Bloomberg, the majority of them people of color. And the value of this, the dismissals is this. When you think about closing Rikers, this is the sort of leadership I'm hoping for from Mayor de Blasio, but that we're getting at least from a couple of these, a few of these district attorneys, which is it prevents people from going to jail and facing the devastating consequences for themselves and their families. It gets us closer to closing Rikers by reducing the population, and it saves people from unfair deportation and from families from being ripped apart. So this is the sort of leadership we're asking for from the New York City mayor, and surprisingly, the district attorneys have stepped up to do this. But it's not the end of the road. There's more that needs to happen, and here's where the mayor can step in. The retroactive dismissal is important, but the mayor needs to stand up. Like, Cy Vance decided to not prosecute turnstile jumping a few weeks ago, and the more we...
And Cy Vance is the Manhattan DA.
The Manhattan District Attorney. And the more we realize that there are all these charges that actually don't lead to people threatening public safety, is the more we can reduce our jail population and have a smaller, fairer, more humane criminal justice system in New York City.
Well, I just also want to remind our New York City listeners that we do have, you know, these DA positions are all elected positions, and we do have elections coming up on November 7th of this year. Don't forget that New York City voters vote on an odd number year, and so all city council members are up for election, the mayor, the comptroller, the public advocate, and DAs. So if they're impressed and pleased with the direction it's going, they can also reelect or not.
Absolutely. I think that gets lost on a lot of folks that the district attorneys are elected. Let me say one other thing for your listeners who may be more focused on the fiscal cost of a place like Rikers. We spend $247,000 per bed per year. We spend $22,000 per student in New York City. We have one correction officer for every detainee at Rikers in a city that has one teacher for every 15 students.
Listeners, so I'm sure you all have some thoughts. Please give us a call. Are you encouraged by the local criminal justice reform efforts? Maybe you've had a warrant or summons dismissed. How do you feel about broken windows policy changes? Call us here at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692 if you want to weigh in on where criminal justice reform needs to go from here. In case you're just joining us, I'm Christina Greer, filling in for Brian Lehrer. I'm with Glenn Martin of Just Leadership USA. So Glenn, it didn't seem like, or it did seem like actually, there was a lot of momentum building after Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and it drew attention to issues of race and mass incarceration, largely for many people who had never really thought about these issues in-depthly. And then there was the 13th documentary by Ava DuVernay, and you had Senators Booker and Paul working across the aisle, doing their little duet about criminal justice reform. But then came the election of Donald Trump and his view of American cities as hotbeds of crime and criminal activity and gangs and ill repute. So has the change from President Obama's Department of Justice to President Trump's significantly change or halt the progress that you're doing?
You know,
from Obama's DOJ to Trump's DOJ?
I appreciate the question, and absolutely. There's been a significant change on the federal level with respect to the federal government's opinion about who we should be locking up in this country and for what reasons. At the same time, I remain hugely optimistic. While I had the opportunity to be part of Obama's reform efforts, and I put a lot of value in what him and his administration was able to accomplish, the fact of the matter is that that work rests on top of local work that had been happening for over a decade around the country. And if you look today, locally at Louisiana, for instance, a red state with the highest incarceration rate in the world, in June, they passed a remarkably comprehensive legislative overhaul that's expected to drastically reduce its incarceration by 10% over the next decade. In Connecticut, significant bail reform just happened. Raise the Age happened recently. In Oklahoma, another red state with a high incarceration rates, there were bills passed to lower the prison population. So there's much work to do, but I think that the cat is out the bag, particularly locally, where, you know, if people want to resist the Trump administration, if that's their perspective, then guess what? This is an issue that you can actually resist on a local level and have meaningful outcomes that keep families together, keep people employed, connected to housing and education and healthcare and so on. And so that's why I have such a difficult time living in such a progressive city with such a progressive mayor. And I'm totally taken aback at the fact that it would take 10 years for such a resource-rich city to figure out how to do something better than what we're doing at Rikers, where 50% of the population turns over every 10 days because most people are there poor with very low bail.
Right. And we know that a debtor's prison is something that the Founding Fathers actually said was not something that we should do. And unfortunately, it's the 21st century and we're still replicating it in some ways. So you wrote last year in the Chicago Defender, one of the oldest black newspapers in the country, about the six ways Barack Obama reformed the criminal justice system while he was in office. You highlighted that he actually met with federal inmates, for one, and he was the first and only sitting president to do so, if my memory serves me correctly.
That's right.
And so that was highly unusual for a president. What are some of the other, I guess, somewhat unusual things that President Obama did when we think about mass incarceration and the criminal justice system?
Sure. So our president at the time, President Obama, decided to do a significant number of pardons, almost 2,000, more than any president over the last 64 years in the United States. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up the fact that he went into a prison, because going into a prison and then having breakfast with some of the people that he pardoned, to me, was part of the value President Obama brought to the table. He was working on humanizing people who've been involved in our criminal justice system, recognizing that you don't get to the point where 100 million Americans have a criminal record on file unless first you've actually dehumanized those folks. And so his concrete policy reforms, whether it was pardoning people, bringing higher education back to the criminal justice system, or some of the other concrete things that were done by DOJ and through executive order, but the added value was the fact that this president was willing to stand alongside people who have become the sort of human carnage that our criminal justice system churns out, and reminding Americans that these are our brothers, sisters, cousins, and uncles.
So what are you able to bring to this debate with your own history of incarceration? I mean, you seem to have a very unique perspective as well.
I appreciate that. So, you know, at Just Leadership USA, we believe that people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but furthest from power and resources. We actually built the Close Rikers campaign by investing in the very people who have been most harmed by Rikers. And I would argue that that's the reason we built power so quickly and were able to bring the mayor on our side so quickly. Similarly, around the country, we have trained over 370 formerly incarcerated people in 29 states plus D.C., because we believe that their voice, their experience, their experiential knowledge, and their inclusion in policy reform spaces mean that we move away from incrementalism as the sole approach and recognize that we need solutions that match with the scope of the problem. People I know who've actually served time in prison recognize that an argument about releasing first-time nonviolent marijuana offenders is a joke. I met some of America's best and brightest in prison, and in prison you barely ask about what brought a person there, but you end up learning about a person's humanity. You learn that human beings have a tremendous amount of power to do wrong and a tremendous amount of power to do good in this world, and we all contain the ability to do both of those things. And so no human being is trash. We recycle everything in this country except human beings, it seems, and formerly incarcerated folks just wouldn't allow for that to happen in their policy reform efforts, and that's where we make our investment.
In case you're only just joining us, I'm Christina Greer, filling in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm here with Glenn Martin from Just Leadership USA. We're going to take some calls. There's Craig from Morganville, New Jersey. Craig, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome to WNYC.
Hi. I agree with everything this gentleman is saying. However, with the flip side, problem is, how do you stop the quality of life from going down? I don't want to arrest everyone who's hopping turnstiles or who gets caught smoking weed. What if they all know they can't get arrested for it?
Yeah, that's...
I don't think people who are smoking weed should get arrested. In my opinion, I think prostitution should be legalized. But I think, and there are so many people that are in jail that shouldn't be. Rockefeller law should be eliminated. I get that. But the flip side is the few ruin it for the many. So how do you stop the quality of life from going down?
Thanks so much for your question, Craig.
Craig, I appreciate the question. If you and I were sitting 15 years ago in New York City at a time when we had 22,000 people on Rikers and 135,000 admissions each year, and we had this conversation, you'd be saying the same thing. But if you look at New York City, again, we've cut the jail population in half, and quality of life has gone up significantly in New York City, and crime has gone down significantly. I care about victims as much as anyone else. I would argue that if we actually focused on victimization, we'd have a better outcome than what we do now. When I was the victim of a crime in New York City, I found that I was an undeserving victim as a young person of color. Had I been a more deserving victim at that time, maybe my own outcomes would have looked differently, to be quite frank. I mean, I find that if we invest in communities that are high crime and high victimization, but move some of those resources further upstream, we'd get much better outcomes and even some of the outcomes that you're looking for. I mean, when you ask people why do they jump the turnstile, I think that the answers that come from them are addressable at a much lower cost than $247,000 per bed per year. And I bet they have a lot to do with poverty and lack of access to jobs and housing and health care. I live in a city where if you walk down Park Avenue from the Bronx down into the city, you see a Park Avenue that changes drastically below 96th Street. And it's not because there are more police cars and more guard towers and more parole officers. It's because there is more access to education, housing, health care, and meaningful employment.
So Glenn, most of my students know that my favorite U.S. city is Baltimore. Sorry, New Yorkers. But with your campaign, like hashtag Close Rikers, it's tied to one specific jail. And so can you talk to us about the national role that has to play? And does it transfer to other cities like Baltimore, Philly, D.C., Atlanta, even Chicago, you know, or some of the tier two cities, say Hartford, or sorry to call them tier two cities, but in academia, that's what we do. You know, some of the smaller cities that are out there, you know, your Columbus's or Cleveland's or whatever it may be.
Sure. Remember, the Close Rikers campaign, the actual focal point, Rikers Island, as a piece of land, again, that was purchased from a slave owner, is a way to focus the effort to get to the finish line. Having said that, speedy trial reform, bail reform, discovery reform, and all of the other policy mechanisms that need to be changed to get to the finish line is also part of the work. It's just not front and center. We learned that if you listen to the people who are being harmed and you have them tell you as an institution what it is they get fired up about, what it is they want to focus on, that you can actually build a campaign around those things, organize people around those things, and build the power you need to do the policy reform. I mean, as someone who came out of prison and landed at a public interest law firm, it was great to learn how to do sophisticated, behind closed doors, legislative policy reform. But I find that that doesn't change hearts and minds. And so at the time when the Mayor de Blasio said, yes, we should close Rikers, the value, yes, is now New York City's on the record as moving towards closing Rikers. But the added value, which most other people didn't see, was how many phone calls we got from around the country from people saying, you know what, we haven't been bold enough in our campaigns. If you look at Milwaukee, for instance, an organization called Ex-Prisoners Organizing has decided to go from addressing conditions of confinement in the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility to creating a closed MSDF campaign that we are supporting from behind the scene, but that is much more bold and audacious than where they started. So yes, this can have a ripple effect around the country and in cities in particular where there's huge racial disparities, where poor people, whether they're white or black, are disproportionately impacted. There's two things you can organize in this country, money and people. And our criminal justice system has affected so many people that we can build much more power than any elected official that's standing there trying to hold on to mass incarceration.
So in California, we know that the prison population has been reduced by 30,000 men and women in 6 years. In Connecticut, we've also seen a drop in the number of incarcerated people. So to what extent do the budget considerations bolster reducing incarceration rates? So is that figuring out into the support that you're seeing for Close Rikers in other cities and states across the country?
You know, folks find the $247,000 per bed per year sticker tag on Rikers Island to be obnoxious, and rightfully so. At the same time, we don't get to the finish line on ending mass incarceration if the argument is solely about the cost of locking people up. Because the double-edged sword of that argument is that if we had unlimited resources, then what we're actually doing is okay. And the truth is, again, if you care about victims, we have a incarceration system in the United States where 2/3 of people who are released reoffend at some point. And I can't think of any other industry in the world that would continue to operate with such a failure rate. This one doesn't only continue to operate, but we continue to feed it resources. And so the financial argument tends to bring some of the more conservative players to the table. And I think it is important to have them paying attention and have them invested. But if we're going to emerge with a criminal justice system that looks wholly different than the one we have now, one that replicates some of the things we see in places like Germany and Norway and other countries, then the fiscal argument alone is not going to get us there.
So on the other side, though, we see stock prices for private prison companies rising right after Trump's election. So there is this very clear link between the economics of the prison industry and people who rely on prisons for their incomes are sort of opposing this sort of shrinkage that you are advocating for, I'm guessing.
You know, I have an older brother who grew up to be a federal correction officer and is now a U.S. Marshal. Makes Thanksgiving complicated at my house. But, you know, he's one of the 3 million Americans that benefit directly from being employed in a criminal justice system that spends $80 billion per year to operate. That's not even counting law enforcement and the courts and everything else associated. But I would go even further than private prisons. You know, first of all, private prisons were born out of a system that already had very perverse incentives to begin with, right? Like, you wouldn't start a private industry based on a public system unless you realize that there's some really profitable opportunities in there. And in our criminal justice system, the private prison system has decided to evolve itself and now is doing reentry services, now is doing probation, now is doing electronic monitoring. And then let's not forget that, you know, yes, let's look at the private prisons, but if you go back to the government institutions for a second, if I run a hotel down the block from Attica Correctional Facility, I'm probably doing well. Like, I know families of prisoners are going to come up and stay in this hotel. If I'm doing laundry services for the facility, if I'm delivering commissary to the facility. So, you know, I never forget a correction officer when I was leaving prison said to me, "You being here helped me get my boat, and when your son gets here, he's going to help my son get his boat." As difficult as it was to hear that, it was important for me to hear because, you know, everyone argued about Obama's stimulus plan. I would argue that prisons in rural communities all across this country have been one of the most longstanding and profitable plans for these communities when businesses went away in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Many governors across the country replaced those businesses with prisons. And so getting out of this mess is not just about good and bad and victims and offender. It's also about the fact that many Americans depend on this industry for their livelihood.
In case you've just joined us, I'm Christina Greer filling in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm speaking to Glenn Martin from Just Leadership USA, and we have a few more minutes. And Glenn, I want to touch on something else because we've talked about the economics. We've talked about expanding to different cities. We see that, you know, certain jail populations across the cities are shrinking to a certain extent. There's still this concern and fears of violent criminals in neighborhoods and many politicians, especially in the Trump era, taking law and order stands. We heard that in the last segment with Sarah Gonzalez. But I want to switch a little bit more and talk about stigma. So there have been many people who have been in and out of jails, in and out of prisons. But let's talk a little bit more about this reentry piece, which you all also tackle. So in 2015, you went to the White House, Obama's White House, along with 40 other criminal justice experts. And while your colleagues were given green passes, you got a pink one that said, "Needs escort." What was that about? And can you talk to us a little bit more about fighting stigma as part of the advocacy work that you're also doing, not just closing these prisons?
Sure. Well, first of all, the thing I'd point out is the nonpartisan nature of our response to what happened in that instance and how formerly incarcerated people tend to get well beyond the political aspect of this work, myself included. So I was invited to the White House to speak to some of the most senior policy advisors to the President of the United States, which, as you can imagine, in my career would be sort of the culmination of your work. And I get to the White House and I get that literal scarlet letter and I'm denied access. And I decided on my way home on the Amtrak train to sit down and pen a letter to President Obama and then really thought about the millions, tens of hundreds of millions of people who've been through our criminal justice system and what it would mean to put the administration on blast, essentially, about having a policy that really undergirds this entire underclass of citizenship that we've created in this country? And what does it mean when a guy like me, 15 years out, having shown all of this investment in other people, whether it's in New York or across the country, can't get into the White House? What does that mean for a young lady who's coming home from prison today and walks down the block to try to get a job at McDonald's? And so it was an opportunity to publicly address the stigma, and I decided to have that letter published in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, and it created a conversation around the country about what we call collateral consequences, the lifetime punishment associated with a criminal record. It also gave me a chance to meet with President Obama one-on-one to have a very intimate conversation about our criminal justice system and a White House that perpetuates the stigma of a criminal record in a country where criminal record-based discrimination is a surrogate for race-based discrimination, whether it's intentional or unintentional.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Glenn Martin, president and founder of Just Leadership USA and the co-founder of the hashtag Close Rikers campaign.